Welcome to The Sustainable Life. This is Josh Spodek, and I'm here with Trish Ellis and Evelyn Wallace. How are you guys doing?
Great. I'm well, thanks.
Glad to have you here. I'm going to describe what this episode is about. Today's guest, our main guest, Trish, has terminal cancer. Taking my workshop, she had to miss a session for chemotherapy. Now, I'll let her describe her situation, and obviously there's much more to her than that condition. But I want to frame this. Have you ever thought, as I have, about some news like that there's going to be more plastic in the ocean than fish in 2050? I thought, I was born in 1971, so in 2050, I'll be 79. That sounds like a pretty big problem for someone else. And people my age and older can think that way. There are many problems. Even though we think that way, there are still many problems that are happening sooner than the scientists predicted because they tend to be conservative. And then after thinking that way, a lot of old people say, oh, we have faith in the next generation that they'll solve the problems that we created. But then the young people think, up yours, and they become as helpless as we did, probably sensing that our parents had faith in us, and we also failed, I guess, future generations. Well, if anyone can say, I worked all my life, and I deserve a chance to indulge without thinking of future generations, I don't think anyone would judge a terminal cancer patient for thinking that way. On the contrary, other people, I think, want someone like that to indulge so that they can say or that they can feel better themselves about violating their own values. And Trish wasn't looking for sustainability. She wasn't like, how can I be more sustainable? She had planned, I think, 6 or 7 decades to spend her retirement flying around the world. And she took the workshop, not because she was looking for a workshop, but because her niece, Evelyn, who's here too, because she took it. Evelyn wasn't looking for it either. She wasn't trying to be sustainable. She contacted me for corporate leadership training and then ended up going that direction instead. They're both doing leadership sustainability or sustainability leadership because they like it. Trish, as I understand, we'll hear from her, prefers spending her precious time left creating a legacy, not in self-indulgence. Actually, I think she is self-indulging in creating that legacy, in helping others, in finding ways to motivate her friends in retirement to greater joy in leading sustainability rather than in hedonism of flying around the world. I have to tell you, many people describe me living off the grid in Manhattan, hosting this podcast, and all these things that I do as pushing the frontier and extreme. I constantly get called that. Well, it looks to me like Trish's every hour is more precious to her than mine aren't to mine, to me. So she's inspiring me. So I wanted to bring her here, and I hope I didn't. Trish, did I characterize you fairly? Is this how you feel? Have I missed important things? What's your situation? And Evelyn, feel free to pop in too when appropriate.
Thanks, Josh. Yes, absolutely. I do have terminal cancer, and I wasn't looking for sustainability issues to address before I heard from Evelyn and my sister, Beth, who's Evelyn's mom, about this program. And I was touched by how it had inspired Evelyn. And I wanted to not only support her, but find out, you know, why was she so inspired by this? And, you know, what could I learn from it? So that's how I got connected with you. And I'm so happy I did.
And Evelyn, how did you get started? I mean, I know because it was with me, but can you share how you got started, how you shared it with Beth, and how Beth shared it with Trish?
Yeah, right. I'll try to just give the short answer to this. I'm enrolled in a master's program in social work. I'm on a macro track, so there's a lot of leadership development skills that are part or are hypothetically part of the curriculum. And so, Josh, I had read a little blurb about you in The New Yorker and found that you did, essentially corporate coaching and leadership training. So when I reached out about that, you very kindly and it was empathetic, really, guided me towards sustainability leadership, which I felt, you know, sort of down for the ride, even though I thought maybe I didn't belong in that room. I thought maybe I was already doing, like, I'm already a good guy, right? Or so I thought. And when I guess I felt in that first workshop, I thought that maybe I had already missed the bus. Like, even though I'm a good guy on one hand of my self-assessment, on the other hand, there's all these other people who are really living in this way that I at the time saw, yeah, as extreme. And so experiencing this mindset shift around, I mean, we, you remember, had a lot of heated debates about, you know, personal action versus systemic change. And I think it was a real, I was really awakened to this reality that it's how interconnected they are, or that that's not really the spectrum that that really is what matters most. And so as I became more and more aware of how sustainability was really the upstream issue of all these other social problems that I wanted to address with my life's energy, I just jumped, you know, jumped 2 feet into the world of sustainability leadership. And yeah, I TA'd some of the next courses after I had taken the course. And in doing that, just talked pretty authentically and openly, not really having a lot of, you know, sales experience, but just telling the people in my life how meaningful this experience had been, and that I thought that if they participated, they would also experience something meaningful. And so far, that's been true. Yeah, my mom happened to be visiting when I was enrolled in the first workshop, and she saw firsthand the ways that it was affecting me. And so her interest, it's just sort of grown. And I'm honored that it's grown in our family, because I know, Josh, especially, I know that that's not always true with people to whom we are related.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was something we learned in the first, when I was doing the workshop with you, that I would tell people, do the Spodek method with people who are supportive and non-judgmental, thinking and probably implying, you know, family is often good. And it turns out family is not often a great place to start. They're not always so supportive and non-judgmental. You just can't escape them.
I think we're really fortunate in our family. You know, there are many of us who are supportive and non-judgmental with each other, and that really is helpful in a lot of ways.
Now, Evelyn, I want to ask you, when you said you felt you're already a good guy, I think a lot of people listening to this are thinking, I am one of the good guys. I'm not someone who doesn't care.
Uh-huh.
And different thoughts. Or maybe they feel like, well, there's nothing that anyone can do, so whatever is possible, I'm doing, you know, I've checked off. I saw the article that said, here's 10 things you can do. I'm doing 7 of them.
Right.
That's a passing grade. What was why did you think you were a good guy, and how did that change?
That's a good question. And I'm just going to say out loud here that I'm going to make a conscious effort to talk a little slower, because I know that I tend to speed my words up. So just, I don't know, nudge me if I'm talking too slowly and deliberately. But I suppose I thought I was one of the good guys because when you're steeped in a culture like a tea, you know, you don't question the narratives of your own identity. So I had always been in this identity mindset of environmentalist. I care about the environment. I'm an environmentalist. I camp. I buy outdoorsy brands that my other environmentalist friends also buy. You know, now that you ask, like, it was not that self-assessment of being one of the good guys was not really based on any behavioral data. It was really a matter of, that was just the soup that I was swimming in. I thought that climate deniers, for example, they were the bad guys. And because I knew climate change was a real thing, I was on the side of the righteous. But what I realized is, if you just watch human behavior on mute, you know, like from space, if you're just like studying humans as one of the animal species, but you don't speak our language, but you see what we're doing. What I realized is, if I was watching my own behavior, there's no evidence to support that I was an environmentalist. I wasn't behaving in ways that were in keeping with the value of treading lightly on the earth, of being a good steward of the earth. And I think a big part of that is really, it's like, there's like this economic incentive to not tell that part of the story. Like, I got on planes with a clear conscience in my head, somewhere in my, I mean, it never occurred to me that getting on a plane and dumping poison into the air was my fault. Because everyone else was doing it, so it seemed to me, and because what is me not doing it really going to accomplish? And I think what I ended up seeing through the mindset shift that happens really through the Spodek method and through building a community of people who are also choosing to see this all differently, it really felt like the whole weight of the world is not mine to pull. That's for sure. And if I stop pulling it, like, the world's not going to fall apart. Okay, so yeah, in that regard, I'm just one little fish in a great big pond full of other fish. On the other hand, like, everything I was given to do was just that one little fish's job. Do you know what I'm saying? So I can either do what's mine to do or not do what's mine to do, even if it's only 1/8 billionth of the piece of the pie. And that in doing what's mine to do, it's actually really fun. It's actually like a very natural antidepressant. It actually solves all these other problems that I thought were unrelated. And it is the fundamental building block of moving toward bigger systemic change, which was the part of the puzzle I hadn't really seen before.
What were those problems? The unseen problems? Do you mind sharing?
Sorry. Just remind me, the unseen problem.
You said it solved lots of other things.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so depression. When I had been, I mean, we were coming out of COVID. I think a lot of, it was a pretty dark and lonely and isolated era. I felt like I had discovered some things about how to take care of my own self, my mental health, living in balance, my spiritual self. I had discovered those things and then somehow forgotten them. And by the time sustainability came back into my life, it wasn't like the therapist saying, you should diet and exercise. Or it wasn't like a nutritionist or any, it wasn't coming from this, diagnostic point of view. Or even, I mean, there's arguments to be made about how even, you know, looking at mental health through like a mental illness lens is a shaming and blaming mechanism. So it felt like I wasn't even saying the word depression, but I was getting on my bike once a week to ride my son to daycare, which all of a sudden got my heart rate up, which all of a sudden released all these endorphins, which all of a sudden made me want to do it again the next day, which all of a sudden made me pass the same houses so often that people start calling out, oh, hey, we've been wanting to talk to you. Oh, hey, I see my apple tree's full of apples. Do you and your son, my grandson's the same age as your son. We've been hoping you would stop. So those kinds of things, it's like I didn't know how sustainability and isolation, how sustainability was an antidote to isolation. It didn't make sense to me. And until I found my own path to it and it revealed itself.
So I'm going to keep asking you questions, but I'm going to switch to Trish.
Very good.
If you don't mind. And Trish, so you saw, I guess, your sister Beth, or maybe also Evelyn. How did this stuff come to you? And actually, before doing that, if you haven't shared it too many times, do you mind sharing how you learned about cancer and what's going on, where you stand and what things look like?
Sure. I'll answer the first question first, and that is, I think, right after my sister Beth was with Evelyn and learned about this program and saw the impact it was having on her, he came here to Hawaii and was just telling me how, kind of the things that Evelyn was just sharing, how this program seemed to be an antidote. She didn't use that word, but that's the word that comes to me right now, for many of the issues that Evelyn had been working with over time, and that it seemed to be, you know, a real positive influence for her. And also that learning about these issues through Evelyn made her start thinking differently about them. And so we had conversations about that. and about sustainability and, you know, the kinds of things that we had been doing and not doing. And so it opened up that conversation for me.
Am I right that it came out of left field for you? Like you weren't pursuing sustainability before, or did you study any parts of the environment before?
No, I never really studied it at all. You know, I had some awareness about issues of sustainability and, you know, in terms of taking care of the environment and creating garbage and, you know, being cautious about packaged food and, you know, just and biodegradable detergent, you know, things like that, that I were in my awareness. But it wasn't something I was pursuing in a direct way at all. It was just, you know, kind of an awareness that I paid attention to in peripheral ways, but not in a real direct way.
So what were your conversations? You described conversations you had with Beth after Beth spent time with Evelyn. Do you mind sharing some of those, what they were about?
Yeah, like I said, they had to do with how this program and these issues were such a positive influence for Evelyn and how that influenced Beth to start thinking about sustainability issues differently. And so our conversations had to do with that and also with, you know, small things that we could do that could make a difference that we hadn't thought about doing before, you know, in our own lives, not anything dramatic, but, you know, what else is there to do that I could do that would contribute to the world in this way?
Do you remember any snippets from those conversations? I'm curious how they went.
I wish I could, but one of the issues with chemotherapy is it creates many holes in my memory.
Oh.
So a lot of times I don't remember specifics about many things. Sorry.
No apology necessary. I'm also wondering, you told me in a previous conversation that you basically expected to travel in your retirement. Do you remember, like, what was your, I mean, I think you said you worked your whole life so that you could travel in your retirement.
Well, it's a little bit different than that, in that I don't know that I ever expected to retire totally, but the work that I've done for maybe involved with for the last 40 years involved a lot of traveling and connecting with people in different parts of the world. And so I imagine that as long as, you know, I was able, that would be part of my life. And I also really do enjoy traveling. I don't enjoy traveling as a tourist, though. I like traveling with a purpose. And so that's really what I imagined I'd be doing if I were healthy, that I would still be traveling for a purpose and connecting with, you know, with wonderful people in different parts of the world in person. But for various reasons, you know, I'm still connecting with wonderful people in different parts of the world through technology as opposed to traveling in a plane. So that's probably a benefit in the long run.
So I'm curious about how that change happened, but can you share the diagnosis? And I don't know how many, is that something you've shared so many times you get bored of sharing it, or is it sensitive? Or
no, it's not sensitive really. I was originally diagnosed with cancer, 2009. That's when I had treatment the first time. And then I was pretty much, you know, I thought I was done with it until about 12 years later. So 2020, I was diagnosed with metastatic cancer.
And was that a different thing than the first one, or?
It was breast cancer that had metastasized to my bones and my lungs. So that's what my diagnosis is currently, is I have metastatic cancer in my bones and my lungs and lymph nodes, I guess. And medically, They say, as long as I want to stay on Earth, I will need to continue doing chemo probably for as long as I want to stick around. So I did chemo for 6 months last year. Then I took about 7 months off, which was probably too long. And I started chemo again. So that's where I am now, is I'm doing chemo to slow things down enough to stick around and enjoy this earth and people I love for a little bit longer.
Was it a fair characterization when I said that you could be doing other things and that you've chosen maybe through the workshop or maybe through the conversations with Beth and Trish and Evelyn that like you're choosing a different path?
I don't know that my path is a different path. I think the path has expanded. Yeah. It's a little bit wider path, I would say, because, you know, my path has, from a long time, has been focused on being of service in one way or another. And, you know, it's been important to me to feel like I'm making a contribution to others. And that's what makes life meaningful for me. And so the conversations with Evelyn and Beth and participating in the program and hearing other younger people talk about their passions and their experiences has widened my path to include environmental issues that and awareness about those things and a willingness to, you know, share about those things and include them in the other kinds of work that I do, where if I hadn't had that connection and participated with you, you know, I just wouldn't have been within my purview of things to even think about or talk about with others.
Do you mind?
What were those experiences? Oh, sorry. You know, I should let Evelyn, what were you going to say, Evelyn?
I was going to jump in and, yeah, just ask Trish to expand on the 40 years of experience you were talking about and the kind of work that you do. I love hearing you talk about this, and I think others will too.
Well, thanks, Evelyn. Yeah, I worked with a psychiatrist, Jerry Jampolsky. He passed away a few years ago, but he started the first support groups for kids with cancer back in the 70s. And I've worked with him since the mid-80s. In fact, Sarah, Evelyn, I don't know if you are aware of this, but it's really because of you that I got connected with Jerry Jampolsky.
Oh, really? In what way?
I attended your christening.
Oh, my.
In 1982 at Tiburon Christian Church. And Jerry and two other people who became my closest friends for years and years were speaking at that service.
I didn't even know I was christened.
All right, if we're going to talk about christening and Evelyn, then I'm going to tell a similar story because I knew that when Evelyn contacted me, there was someone else who contacted me from Corvallis, Oregon. I knew that my mom and dad lived in Corvallis before driving across the country and settling in Philadelphia where I was born. So I said to my mom, oh, by the way, I was talking to someone in Corvallis. And without missing a beat, she goes, you were conceived there.
Thanks, Ma.
See, Evelyn, you're responsible for a lot of things you never knew about. Oh, that's great.
Oregon, that'll do it to you.
Love it.
Okay, so you were talking about you're with the psychiatrist that Evelyn's christening led to, connecting to.
Yeah. Yeah, so Jerry started the first support groups for kids with cancer, and he developed a social-emotional learning model called attitudinal healing that was based on his work with kids with cancer. And so I have worked with that model over the years and trained facilitators to facilitate groups and offer social-emotional learning programs. And I think one of the things that I really appreciated about your model, Josh, is that, you know, my life work has mostly been supporting people to become aware of their inner landscapes and to take responsibility for the choices that we make moment by moment about everything, you know, the thoughts that we hold in our minds, the emotions that we cultivate within ourselves, and, you know, how those choices, those inner choices, get reflected in our external world and in our actions and our behaviors. And so I really appreciated that it seemed to me in your model, you started there. You know, you started with supporting people to become aware of their inner connections with nature and what kinds of emotions got created by their relationship with nature and how, you know, they could cultivate those internal experiences and express those in their actions and could use them to motivate them, us. We could use those to motivate us to take action in the world that was in alignment with not only our positive emotions, but our significant values that we hold. And so I saw a real correlation between the way your model works in the sustainability world and how the attitudinal healing model works in working with people who are in crisis in some way.
Yeah.
So there seemed like an alignment to me that was felt positive.
You describe it so much better than I do. Maybe because of all that experience in the field. I mean, Evelyn I think she says it less now, and she says, how do I put it? Properly says, you know, I don't want to like be too much into traditional definitions of masculinity and femininity or whatever, but she's like, Josh, you're way too masculine in your descriptions, because to me it's like, do these things, do this step and then this step and then this step, and it'll work. But I don't think so much of like the other side of how it feels. I mean, I do have those feelings too.
Sure. Well, and you know, maybe I was projecting, but it did seem to me that you had a start there, you know, in those initial conversations, starting with, you know, what experiences do we have that led us to feel connected to nature and that generated our experience of feeling connected with nature. So, you know, I was very comfortable working from the inside out. And, you know, some people work from the outside in, but I'm an inside out person.
And I suspect just before this call, I sent Evelyn the first draft of the how-to guide for the workshop. And I suspect she might come back and say, Josh, you left out all that stuff that Trish said you left that part out. Like the part that people value most, the how they feel. Oops.
Yeah.
But we'll see. Maybe not. I mean, it might be. It's just a how-to guide.
Yeah. I mean, there are different, you know, different ways of approaching things that work for different people, for sure. And then whatever I was going to say next has left me, so if it comes back, I'm still on stage.
I was just thinking about the metaphor of how the two sides of every binary need each other. So like the south side of the mountain needs the north side of the mountain. The crest needs the trough. So yeah, Josh's approach, I do think, tends to be, for what it's worth, masculine in that, you know, I mean, that's one name for it, but you can also say linear or,
yeah,
you know, see, it's not just rational versus emotional, but I mean, there's a million things to say about like masculine versus feminine. But yes, I do think that the bullet points are great. I love the how to sort of step-by-step guide. And I think I love that it still leaves room for coming in. I mean, I think right away I started to recognize within the Spodek method similar principles to like motivational interviewing and other, you know, clinical techniques that I'm not that interested in social work, but I'm learning about anyway. And it seems like there's, you know, these other fundamental alignments between the Spodek method and, other methodologies that are effective, like the attitudinal healing that you've been working with, Trish. And that's where I feel like we really are, like, this approach really does tap into something universal. And it doesn't, just because it has been, just because Josh has made a formula around it to make it easily accessible, doesn't mean that it's somehow devoid of those deep and profound emotions. In fact, it seems like the whole thing is built around doing our best to access those most profound of emotions and connections to nature.
Yeah, I mean, that's how it seemed to me. And, you know, I don't know if this is true in a general way, but it seems to me that whatever our external goals are, there are related internal goals. You know, the reason I would want to make the environment better for future generations is because somehow internally that either makes me feel the way I want to feel, whatever that label is, or it's in alignment with my internal value system. And so there's no conflict. You know, there's no inner conflict. I'm not going to have outer goals in general that create inner conflict for me.
Right.
So, like you were describing earlier, Evelyn, how when you got into doing things in a sustainable way, like riding your bike, you know, there were other things, internal changes that happened, relationship changes that happened. So it's not just the action of doing a sustainable task.
Great.
But it's all connected to our internal experience and our relationships. And to me, that holistic view is what's most important to me.
I love that.
Now, in my defense, I have a big goal. I have several goals in this. One of them is to make it spreadable and to make it easy to learn for people who want to not just experience having someone lead them through the Spodek method, but to lead others through it and also to teach others, to be able to teach others and so forth.
Uh-huh.
And so I want to communicate this direct, like, here's how to do it. And I sometimes forget in the workshop when I tell people, here's how to lead others, is that you're going to be bringing up very powerful emotions in people and oftentimes making them, you know, a lot of people don't talk about the environment, or they talk about it very abstractly. They talk about, like, paper versus plastic, or, oh, individual action versus collective action, or will we reach fusion, but not how do I feel about recognizing this internal conflict? Like, I'm contributing to it and I can say all I want that I can't help it, or society or someone else, but that doesn't change that, you know, I'm filling the gas tank. And so we do have to be very careful that people can feel very vulnerable. And then when they share how they feel, they can be bring up big internal conflict. And it could be years and years, especially if they have kids, and or if they are kids, even more, maybe more so, or in different ways. And we have to be very careful not to just take for granted that they'll feel better later.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's both sides are really important. Like you said earlier, Evelyn, it's not one or the other. It's not the linear versus the emotional. It's really, you know, the combination that makes it powerful, I think.
Right. They need each other.
Yeah, they do, in my opinion.
So how did you feel when you were doing it, Trish? Because am I right that, did you also go through these things that I did of there's going to be more plastic in the ocean than fish by 2050, but, you know, I'm going to be pretty old by then, so probably not too bad for me. And I think kids today probably really resent that adults are acting that way and saying, oh, kids, well, you'll fix it.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny because for me, you know, at my age, you two are like two different generations. Well, behind me. So you are the ones who are, you know, picking up the slack that we screwed up, you know?
We were supposed to pick it up. I don't think we're picking it up. I think we're doing what Evelyn talked about. It's like identifying. It's like, yep, I'm helping. I wish everyone else was. They're not, so it doesn't look so good for the world, but at least I'm doing my part in caring, but not backing up that caring with acting.
With action, yeah.
Yeah.
But Ajay, I'm talking about you two individual people.
Oh, us, yeah.
Not as representatives of those generations. And you two individual people are, you know, taking action and doing things differently than most of the people in my generation, you know, most of the individuals in my generation have been willing to take on. And, you know, certainly there are exceptions in my generation, too, of people who are much more conscious and aware than I, who have taken more steps that have made a difference. But, you know, on the positive side, it's inspiring to me to see the two of you and the other people in the cohort that I participated in who are all, you know, in other generations that I'm in, for sure. How creative you each are in your own lives and, you know, how committed you are to being a difference, not just, you know, doing small actions, but actually creating change. So, you know, to me, that's very inspiring. And I'm grateful to see that in you and the people who are connected with you, Josh.
I wonder who's inspiring whom the most of the three of us in the call. I think it's a three-way tie.
Yeah.
Evelyn, what's it like for you? I mean, she's a close family member. Your mom's involved. I mean, I remember when you took the workshop last year, like at the beginning, it wasn't working with your mom. And you were like, this stuff isn't working. Something like that. I don't remember. What's it like from your perspective, seeing your mom and your aunt get into this?
I have to say I'm really proud. I feel like Team Evie is really showing up. And yeah, I'm honored that, I mean, my path has come from a place of, you know, basically my life changed when I watched a friend die in 2016. And one thing leading to another after that awakening and really dedicated to following a life path that really mattered. I wasn't just going to follow the rules as I had been taught. Every decision I made from then on out was with more conscious attention and alignment with what my deeper values, the like looking death in the eyes value. Like what, okay, well, yeah. My day will come too. Like I get it now. And I mean, I know Josh, you had said earlier, like, all right, Trish, like you're probably a little closer to the end of the line. So like, thank you for being here. And also what, you know, how do we have a conversation about sustainability when, I don't know, how can that relate to where other people are in their lives and how close we are, okay, to the end of the line. But what I learned is death doesn't owe us an announcement and that it's a beautiful gift if we get some sort of sense of like, that. Okay, we get this much longer. And I'm not, I mean, that's, we could, I don't know, philosophize. We could wax poetic about, you know, death and time and life and living. And, you know, is it better to just sort of be snuffed out in a surprise or, you know, have some sense of like get to say goodbye? And I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I'm not really here to get deep into that. I just feel like I have lived knowing that death will come for me someday and that every day I have is really quite miraculous and quite precious, and that I wasn't going to do anything with that time on earth that didn't feel worthy of that miracle. And in coming to sustainability and knowing that I've already broken out of a lot of shells and a lot of sort of cultural conditioning, and I've been, you know, the family weirdo for more than once, to finally be able to share something that was so deeply true, that like resonated so deeply like with the values that were unequivocally clear, I suppose, in that moment of looking at death, living in alignment with that and bringing me here and being able to, for my family to see that and jump in and then see it for themselves, that has been, those are the days where I feel like I end the day saying, okay, I can die proud. If I, you know, if I got hit by a bus tomorrow, I can die proud. Because it's not, I mean, I don't want to get hit by a bus. I'm not inviting, you know, I should probably stop saying that as an example, because I don't mean to manifest it. But ultimately, given that who knows when my day will come, if I spent my days doing this, sharing this, and then that feels like a day well spent. And it's new for me learning platforms, and thank you for letting me go on for a minute about this. It's really fun to talk about, but the fact that the Spodek method, which it's always funny for me to talk about because it's not about Josh. Just developed this thing out of lots of lots of education, lots of life experience, lots of trial and error. But this little, like, beautiful conversational method that really does have the opportunity, it not just change your own life like it did, you know, my life, but like you say, Josh, it helps you learn how to give it to others too. And that just feels like magic math. That's like the gift that keeps on giving. That's what it's all about. Does that answer the question, or was that just a lot of talking?
And I just want to say something that you said just triggered a thought that I had about the Spodek method. Is one of the things I appreciated about it is that it really is open enough. You know, it is step by step, and it is very, you know, linear and logical, so that it's easier to remember and use. And the actual process is open enough that it allows people to respond in their own way.
Right.
So people can respond in a linear way, or they can respond in an emotional way.
Right.
Or they can respond in it both ways. So it allows people to explore the ideas, you know, within their own framework. It's not locking people into a framework. It's open.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, go exploring that own internal landscape that you were talking about.
Yeah.
It's definitely designed not to impose values on others or motivations on others. It's because I know, I mean, maybe my biggest discovery from this podcast was that everyone, like if I want to teach someone piano, not everyone's going to want to learn piano. If I want to teach them a sport, not everyone wants to play this or that sport, but everyone's got deep, meaningful, passionate, very motivational emotions relevant to the environment. But we often keep them quiet because, especially now, so many people are so pointing fingers about it that no one wants to connect. They all just want to talk about, I don't know, pointing fingers and abstractions. Just, it's like they don't want to go too close to the flame. But it's not a flame. It's like, it's wonderful. I mean, up until recently, it was impossible to live without, you know, a short walk to being on the beach or in the forest, no helicopters flying overhead, no litter on the ground. And people talk about how it's healthy to, like, forest bathe or other experiences in nature, but I don't think that's healthy. I think that's normal. It has been for almost all of a human history.
Right.
And lack of that is unhealthy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people can define normal however they want. Logically, it's the same thing to say it the way most people do or the way that I do. But I think the way I do motivates maintaining and, you know, regenerating and rewilding more nature. But I know why I devoted so much of my life to this. Was it a conscious choice to, I mean, Evelyn, I know, is putting a lot of her life into this. Trish, I think you are too. I mean, either of you could have walked away. Neither of you was planning on this. I got a PhD in physics, so I've been thinking and knowing about nature for a long time, although not acting for much of that time for all sorts of reasons. Did it come out of left field? Was it something that you consciously chose to change how you devoted your resources? What was it like?
I think it wasn't such a conscious choice to, it was a conscious choice to include these issues in my life in a different way. You know, like for me, it's not my singular path like it is for some people. It's I've seen through being with the two of you and the cohort, how I can, like I said earlier, widen my path to include more awareness, more consciousness, more direct action in support of sustaining the environment and protecting nature, where it wasn't in my conscious thought so much at all before, you know, once in a while, but not as pervasive. Like now I think of it every day, you know, and before I thought of it once in a while. And not only do I think of it every day, but I look for ways to contribute in this way. So it's not the only way I'm contributing. There are many ways that I've, you know, developed over years to that are the natural ways for me to contribute to the world and to others. And now I have another way that's included, and I can incorporate it into the other ways that I try to contribute to.
Now, I have to comment on that. A lot of people talk about what's the most important thing someone can do. And some people will say it's avoiding eating meat, and other people say it's avoiding flying, and some people say it's having fewer children. But I contend that the most important, the biggest impact we can have is to lead others. And that's what you're doing. I mean, for one thing, you've sent people our way. You've recommended this workshop to others. And I think that the impact you have through them can be greater than any one person can have, no matter what they do.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I think, and often it's, you know, it's our way of being, our modeling speaks really more loudly than any, you know, direct request or, you know, promotion. Just, I think people see, like I can see a change in Evelyn. And I, when I see that, I want to know more. And so, you know, I think that that happens too. Just as we change, the people in our lives change, and we can be like, I probably am in contact with more people than in a week than many people my age are in contact with because of the work that I do. And I have an opportunity to incorporate a focus and an awareness and a consciousness about environmental issues into the work that I do. And it's, you know, just to support people to be more aware of their values in that,
right,
in that arena. Because I think many people, especially people my age, you know, haven't been that aware of environmental issues. We weren't raised with an awareness about it. And so, and fortunately, a lot of people I'm in connection with now are younger too. So they're going to have more time to think about their own values and to decide on a course of action for themselves, like, you know, like you are offering to people.
And Evelyn, how about you? I mean, I've been closer to you transforming, but did you, I mean, might you have said before the workshop, yeah, I could do it, but I mean, all the things that people say, did you also do this thing of oh, this problem might be bad for someone else, but I, you know, the worst will, I'll be gone before the worst of it happens?
I think I told myself a lot of things about why what I was doing was okay. Mostly, you know, you look left, you look right. Everyone on your left is doing it. Everyone on your right is doing it. And so when you jump into a different pool and people on your left and people on your right aren't doing that anymore, no one has to say, we don't do that anymore. So like, yeah, I mean, I'm thinking about the things that I changed in my life directly based on Spodek method challenges. But and I know you've said this in the past, Josh. It's so the Spodek method helps someone go from experience a mindset shift, sort of go from zero to something more than zero. Or, you know, it's a different, it's a push, it's an initiation. But there are all these other, like Trish was saying, just being part of the cohort and having this community of role models and learning from each other in ways that once you're open to recognizing that, okay, my behavior, in changing my own behavior, I'm not trying to fix everything. I'm just trying to live in alignment with my own values and to see and to continually investigate how I can improve my own life to live in alignment with my own values. And yeah, surprise, surprise, that actually it's not like self-flagellation, you know, it's actually really fun. And it definitely made me start to wonder in the same way of all the other systems I kind of broke out of, like, why, whoever taught me otherwise? Why did I ever think otherwise? But then you realize people do what they learned. And, you know, it, like, at some point, we really didn't know that pouring a bunch of, you know, toxic smoke into the air, like, you know, burning toxic things, like, would have, you know, a long-term effect. And now we do know that the earth's air is not infinite. We can't just infinitely burn poison. So it seems like, okay, we being able to forgive all the things I learned that turned out to be wrong and to continually investigate in my own life, what are these opportunities and how can I learn? How can I check in with my growing and expanding network? I really liked hearing Trish say about incorporating this sort of mindset into your other work, because I think there are lots of ways that you can end up opening the door to that conversation. And I think the Spodek method is a way to have that conversation that we end up positioning ourselves to have. But then, I don't know, even after I had taken the workshop, I definitely got into a lot of environmental debates with people, not like feeling like, oh, I know stuff now. Oh, I have stuff to teach you now. But realizing, oh, shoot, the Spodek method isn't about teaching facts and figures, even though, yeah, they're all still true. So that's been a transformation for me.
Yeah, Trisha, it seems like you might have had some comments about that, about what she said.
Oh, no, I was just reflecting as you were speaking, Evelyn, about how, you know, the Spodek method kind of places us in a position of being curious.
Uh-huh.
You know, so curiosity is kind of an antidote for judgment.
Right.
A lot of times. So that's just something I really appreciate about the method, is that it allows me to listen to other people's experiences and value systems and motivations from a place of curiosity. And that's helpful to me.
Right. That's really something Josh has helped me see, is it only took me half a second to go from, oh, I'm one of the good guys, to, oh, I wasn't one of the good guys, to, no, now I actually really am one of the good guys, to, like, what's wrong with all the other people who aren't the good guys? So Josh has been really helpful in reminding me that the Spodek method is, yeah, just what you said, that it meets people where they are. So it's not about, that's, I think, one of the ways that it's hardest to learn as a practitioner, I suppose, of the method. It's hardest to learn, like, when someone has this, you know, when they're at the action-making stage of a conversation, like, okay, I'm going to make a challenge. And I think it's hard not to jump in and make all these suggestions of, I have an idea, but it's not about you as the guide. It's about the guided.
Yeah, now I'm going to feel good, because I'm going to ask, Evelyn, are you perhaps referring to a recent call that you and I had with Tim?
I think accidentally, yes.
Trish, you were in with Tim, right?
Yes.
You were in that was your cohort. And
yes.
Evelyn, it was like, I've done the Spodek method, I don't know, a couple thousand times by now. And Trish, you're getting up there, but I don't think you're in the thousands yet. And I read him as giving answers that were pat. They were like, he knew what to say. They weren't that genuine.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, I know he wants to share it. He's just protecting himself. So I just have to, like, ask in a way that he will feel comfortable and supported. But also not just accepting something that didn't really answer the question. But what was it like from your perspective, Evelyn?
Well, okay. So again, I think the Spodek method is this really simple tool, but you can always keep learning how to, you can always keep mastering it. So what I hadn't seen really before is how much you can push on, like not push just, well, okay. And I talk about myself pushing back. So maybe that's like the wrong verb to use, but I guess I hadn't, there are like, there's like this underlying intention of it to really dig into someone's own authentic, novel experience. Well, the experience isn't novel, but the recognition of the experience is novel, and sort of the utilization of that experience into a novel, new novel present tense experience. So I don't think I knew how much you could challenge someone's first answer. I don't think, because I was trying to give people a safe space. And so as they opened up and shared, I was letting them. Great. Thank you so much. You named the emotions. You checked the boxes. To me, it didn't even sound pat. It was something else. It was, I guess it wasn't quite rehearsed, but you're right. I mean, in reflection, I suppose there are some people who sort of have this idea somewhere, like the idea is already there on the shelf. And there's one, and sometimes you can see, this is where it gets a little tricky, because sometimes people are like, oh, I've been meaning to do that project, and this is the perfect opportunity to do that project. And that is sometimes the most sort of accurate and effective way to use the Spodek method. So sometimes it is something where that activates someone to follow up on a project they've been meaning to do. But other times, if there's a project that you've been meaning to do, but there's some, I don't know, there was something stale about it, I think you, as a practitioner of the method, Josh, know how to feel, like to feel and hear when people aren't quite giving you that authentic vulnerability that you know how to listen for. And, you know, you can't force someone to do it. And I don't think the Spodek method is at all about forcing anyone to do anything they don't want to do. The first question is, you know, is the environment something that matters to you? So, of course, the ensuing conversation and the vulnerabilities are all consensual. But yeah, I guess it's a, I continue to be amazed by how much more there is to learn, or how many more doors there are to open by using this really quite simple formula.
And Trish, so I had this idea because I just found myself inspired by you, and I wanted to make others feel that inspiration. I wanted to help others feel that inspiration. And so like I had this idea, and I was like, how do I actually present this to her? So I said, my idea was, and you know, we're not yet fundraising. There's a 501c3, but I had the idea of making I don't know how this sounds, it's like too blunt to say it, but a memorial scholarship or memorial fund for you, because so many people out there are like, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we may die. And you're more aware of it at your doorstep than most people are. And yet you're not saying eat, drink, and be merry. Or if I read you right, you're getting more meaning and purpose out of this than you, out of, you know, acting on sustainability than you would be if you, I'm guessing that if you asked for morphine, they'd give it to you. I'm not sure. That is like the extreme mode of eat, drink, and be merry. And was that a good idea? Did I present it well? How does it sound to you? Do you want to have a legacy? Would this help create a legacy for you to help others follow in your footsteps? Did I get that right?
I'd be really honored to play a part in being able to support others to be introduced to, you know, the wonders of supporting nature in their lives, you know, on all levels. And I'm grateful that you would consider putting my name on something that supported others in that way.
And I sent it to Evelyn first to like figure out if this was something I could bring to you. Evelyn, what was it like for you?
The suggestion of a memorial fund for Aunt Trish.
Yeah, because with you, I would say it more directly. With her, I have to like, I'm stumbling over like not to say something insensitive.
Yeah, I guess in a culture that is pretty uncomfortable, I mean, I think Western culture is pretty uncomfortable with the fact that the north side and the south side of the mountain is life and death. And so we don't, you know, we don't tend to talk about that part of the journey as openly or as comfortably as we talk about the rest. But I think just from a personal standpoint of having gotten real comfortable, I mean, at least, yeah, theoretically with my own death, I don't invite it and I don't invite anyone's death, but I understand that all of the trains are going to the same station. So I guess I found that a memorial fund felt like one of those things that, yeah, it's sort of, you put it in the die proud column. You put it in
the what,
like, in the die proud column.
Oh,
like in the, it's not, I'm not really always running a tab of things I do, whether, but I do, it's hard to explain. It's like, if I died today, would this be something I was proud of? And I feel like if it were me, you know, if I were the one who was making, if I can put myself in your shoes, it doesn't stop the thing that we know is unstoppable. And when and where and how, I get those are all variables, but it feels right. It feels right. It feels like a way that's already, like, you're here and this idea of your memory is here. And at some point, you in this body won't be here, but this memory of you that was infused with you while you were still here remains. So that feels like a way to keep you here, but not in the, like, claw against, you know, nature way.
Yeah. Yeah. I love the way you said that. Thanks, Evelyn.
Oh, well, thanks, Trish. I love you so much.
I want to wrap up with a couple questions. One of them is that I've been indulging in asking you questions. So maybe not wrapping up, but do you guys have any questions of each other, of me? Because I've been indulging myself so much because I'm so curious. And the other is, Trisha, is there a message you want to, well, actually both of you, is there a message you want to, you'd want to give directly to the listeners?
My question is a little bit tangential, Josh, is I heard an interview today with somebody who just wrote a book called Climate Capitalism. About, you know, how if capitalism could change in a way that actually supported the environment and supported climate protection. And so, I mean, that it just made me think about, you know, there's such a huge arena that, you know, each of us individually are doing what we can do. And, you know, how is that in the long run? I know there's, you know, the, you know, each of us contributes, takes everybody, but my question is, you know, how do you see, Josh, our individual motivators and actions, you know, affecting the big picture?
Good question.
You know, it seems like, you know, just my composting makes is a tiny drop in the ocean. So how does all of this, in your vision, fit in actually creating a world that's sustainable?
I'll give the short answer, which is, I think that first, no one has, very few people working on sustainability have tried to live sustainably. Well, and so I think there's a widespread belief that it must be worse, that society is on a one-way track toward progress. Why would we want to give up all these amazing things we've gotten just to return to the Stone Age or some Mad Max apocalypse? So people fear, and I think that there's a long history of why we would feel that way, because we live in this world that we don't live sustainably, which means we run out of stuff where we are, so we have to get it from somewhere else. And not everyone wants to give us the stuff that we need. So our ancestors and our culture, actually, it doesn't matter who our ancestors are. Our ancestors could have been the ones who were plundered, but now we're the ones plundering. whatever your ancestral situation was. And, you know, that's really uncomfortable. And so people just don't want to face it. I think a lot of what people talk about is avoiding, they think that they're talking rationally, but they're really trying to avoid facing some internal conflict. And one way to do that is to come up with ideas that have no step one. Like, what's step one on overthrowing capitalism? You can talk about a lot and sound like, oh, look how passionate I am. It's just, if people would just do what I say or do the solution, it would work. But it's, if they knew that after they took effective, meaningful steps, and sometimes it helps, well, it usually helps a lot to have a couple of people around you also take those steps so that you feel like you're swimming downstream instead of upstream. That's another huge element of it. Then they wouldn't try to stop doing it. They would think, I mean, there's no conflict between doing something. I mean, when what you do is joyful and connects you more with family and is healthy and increases national security, and then you don't say, why should I do that?
And cheaper in the long run.
Yeah. Right. And yeah, I'm so glad he said that, because so many people are like, oh, not many people can afford that, because they associate sustainability. All these marketers out there see, oh, there's big demand, they'll satisfy demand, and they don't know the science. So they're just like, okay, here's something that, you know, it doesn't work, but it'll make you feel like you're doing something. And so they think it costs money. But in my experience, every step I've taken has led me to want to take more steps, and has surprised me at how on the other side of each step, no matter what the challenge, there's internal reward and there's community and there's connection every single time. And so I just want to do more and more and more. And since I know that I'm not, like, I'm a quirky guy, but I'm not doing this because I'm a quirky guy. I'm doing this for reasons that are as universal as, you know, drinking water when you're thirsty. It's just deeply rewarding. But no one knows that, because everyone's brought up with these unquestioned beliefs. That's what culture is, that, you know, we must be destroying those cultures because it's improving their lives to bring them to our culture. Our culture's progress, and theirs is stuck back in the Stone Age. So they're, you know, they're savages or barbarians, and people won't use that language today, but that's, you know, the words may change, but the feeling is like, we're better. That's why we have to send teachers in to teach them so they can be like us. Like, we in this culture that, let's say, since the Enlightenment until now, a couple hundred years, we claim that we know more than some other culture that's been around 50,000 years or 100,000 years. Well, and we're not so happy. And we might not have even 200 years more.
Right.
And yet, and it might end up that we're like this little blip in their history, like 10,000 years from now, they're still going like they were. And they just have this story about these people who came through and they had these wheeled vehicles, and suddenly the skies kind of smelled bad, and a bunch of animals that used to be around stopped being around. And then they just disappeared. There was like a mushroom cloud off in the distance or something like that. And we had a bit more birth defects for a while, for maybe a couple millennia, from the mess that they left in the water. But somehow they came in and disappeared. And that might be us on the time scale of other cultures. We who talk about going to the stars and things like that. So I think I said this was going to be a short answer, but it's joyful. It's wonderful. And what I've tried to do with the Spodek method is, one, bring out that joy and wonder and make it actionable. And as Evelyn said before, it replaces the guilt and shame, and it replaces it with enthusiasm and dedication and perseverance and joy and sharing. So I wanted to create something that spread. So if I lecture you a bunch of facts and you're like, oh, that sounds pretty bad, I better do something. What should I do? And I say, here's what you should do. You should comply with this. Then you might do something, but you probably aren't going to be like, now I want to lecture some other people on some facts and numbers and tell them what to do. That doesn't feel like that fun. And fun not being the only thing that would spread. Since it's something intrinsically rewarding and motivational, and we feel gratitude when we get led through it, then I wanted to create something that would spread. And if each person just tells more than one other person, then that's the recipe for exponential growth, at least at the beginning. So I just don't see change happening if people don't want it to.
Right.
And most people, however much they say they want sustainability and clean water, they don't want to they perceive that as coming with risking reverting to the Stone Age, or not risking necessarily, that it will revert to the Stone Age. It will mean that they won't see all those things far away that they always wanted to fly to see. And they might avoid straws if they saw the video with a turtle with a straw in its nose, but they won't go farther. And this changes that. I think you can't possibly get systemic cultural change with 8 billion people pushing back on it. That's how I see it.
I'm going to expand on that because I understand that sense of like, okay, this is cool. This is fun. I can get on board with all those things, but what is me composting really? What's that going to do? And I think another answer or a variation of the answer is it's that the compost is just where it starts. That the first thing you do, or the, you know, as you shift, there's this one sort of, there's a mindset shift of, oh, maybe something I can do might, maybe I'll just try that. And that the idea is that it doesn't end, not only does it not end there, yeah, like Josh was saying, you can't wait to do the next thing in your own life, but it doesn't end there, you know, it doesn't end with you. And that eventually that's, yeah, again, like Josh said, and I am sorry if I'm basically saying everything you just said, but that's what culture is. It's just one big mashup of how we all do it, what we all find to be acceptable or unacceptable, how we eat, how we play, how we live, how we talk, how we don't talk. And so seeing how these dots connect from me, for example, this is like me riding my bike once a week to drop off my son, which turned into, wow, I really like this. And I'm actually spending way less on gas. And wow, I've never spent so much time under the sky. Like I'm getting, whenever the sun's out, I'm actually getting the sun and I'm getting in shape. And, you know, oh, I'm meeting people. It's now, I mean, I'm taking these monthly stats of how far I go now. I just, in the month of March, I biked, Josh doesn't even know this yet, I biked over 400 miles. Over 400 miles. My goal was 250 a month, just commuter, you know, picking up my son, dropping him off. I biked 400 miles because now it's my primary vehicle. I love it. And it's not, one, it's not just ending there, but two, if I want to change the regulations in my town about how wide the bike lanes are, I now have a leg to stand on. So that's one, that's, I guess, another way that those, that to answer the question of like, how does one lead to the other?
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you both. Realistically, I get that that's how social norms get created, you know, and how they change.
Right.
Like you said, if you make one change and the people that you're in connection with are changing, then that becomes the new norm.
Mm-hmm. And then it's like, you don't even have to say it. Oh, we don't do that anymore.
Yeah, it just, yeah.
We don't do that. I've heard so many friends who bike, but who also, they're like, oh, I hate cars when I'm on a bike. I was like, okay, but let the record show you just said you hate cars. So what if we all just rode our bikes? You do see how. You're playing it both ways.
And it only takes a few people around you before that's the norm. Like, there's 8 billion people in the world, but once I had about 5 people around me, then I felt like I was swimming downstream.
Mm-hmm.
True. And so true.
And with the Spotify method, that means that's 5 conversations plus a week for them to do the thing and then another hour for the second conversation. It's like not much.
Really?
And it doesn't cost any money. I didn't have to buy an electric vehicle, which I hope my dismissiveness of electric vehicles came up.
Dang, maybe that's what we're missing, actually. Maybe be something you can buy. Spotify method widget.
Any other questions from either?
Nothing else is coming to mind at the moment.
Then any messages you want to say to the listeners?
Like everything that's coming to mind for me sounds kind of right. Because I would just really encourage people to, if they're listening to this, they've already have some connection with interests in the environment and values that are connected to sustaining the environment and nature. And I would just encourage people to nourish that in whatever way they possibly can and see where it goes. It's going to be someplace good.
Yeah. I guess I would also say, not that that needs a second conclusion, but I would also say that if you're interested in participating in this Trish Ellis Fund, I'm sure there's going to be information about how we'll get that ball rolling. And that if you as a listener out there want to experience this amazing thing that we are talking about, then there are pretty easy pathways to find your way into this world. I'm sure all the links are in the places that they go.
Well, Trish Ellis and Evelyn Wallace, thank you very much.
Thanks, Josh.
Thank you, Josh.
How many people are bringing a message of joy from what everyone calls saving the environment, but I call the future? Step by step, this podcast is creating a culture of joy, community, and connection around sharing and acting on our environmental values. Again, there's no profit in buying and wasting less, but we'll all love our lives and relationships more when we do. I can use your support. Please donate at joshuaspodek.com/donate. Again, that's joshuaspodek.com/donate.